Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 1994, features former United States Court of Appeals Seventh Circuit Judge Richard Posner and Nobel Prize winner Gary Becker. The two use their time to discuss the challenges confronting those who apply market analysis to social questions. We hope you enjoy today's episode and stop back next week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Well, Gary, you're the great pioneer of the application of economic theory to areas outside the traditional domain of economics, and I'm one of your legion of followers. But do you have a sense that we are reaching the limits of the utility of the model of rational behavior?
Well, I don't think so myself. There is always a problem as a field takes off and the application of rational choice, you know, to different areas has expanded enormously. Sometimes the followers are more important than the leaders, and your work on economics is
more fanatical
of great importance. And there have been, you know, research in a variety of questions of family, sexual practices, and many others. Now, every movement of this type leads to a reaction. And we're getting reaction for a variety of reasons. Some of them, I think, explicable by rational choice analysis, that some people aren't happy about this. Their turf is being interfered with. A claim often comes from reacting. And as a result of that, certain areas are being thrown up as areas that are incapable of being explained by rational choice. Now, I think one has to distinguish between what's incapable of being explained and what, as yet, the rational choice analysis has not had great successes explaining. There's no doubt that many areas have not been as yet fruitfully explained by rational choice analysis, including when countries go to war, although people have done some topics on that, and many others one can cite. But it's my belief, maybe my faith, that given the great success in areas where we've so far have were not amenable to rational choice analysis, given the success that we've developed in these areas, that we will find that many of these additional areas will be understood in an insightful way, not just mechanically, but in an insightful way with rational choice. And I think we might now, you know, discuss a few of these controversial areas and give some opinions about what's been accomplished and what remains. And one that I'd like to bring up, because you've just written an important book on this, and have another related book coming out, is dealing with sexual practices. And a lot of people believe, well, that clearly is an area that is not within the bounds of rational choice analysis. Things like homosexual activity, what people do in the face of AIDS, and so on, areas that you've done important work on. So I'd like to get your reaction as this as an example. Mm-hmm. Of an area where it's been claimed rational choice is unsuccessful.
Yeah, well, I've been encouraged by the work on sexuality and sexually transmitted diseases, although it's certainly in its earliest stages. I think the most important initial distinction to make is between preference or orientation, actual behavior. I don't share the view. You may disagree with this. I don't think of a homosexual orientation as something that a person assumes voluntarily after considering the costs and benefits of alternative sexual attitudes, or something that is easily, or perhaps at all, changeable by therapy or threat of punishment, but how people behave in toward their orientation or in response to their orientation, I think, well within people's power of choice. We've seen dramatic shifts in homosexual behavior in response to the AIDS mm-hmm. epidemic and the adoption of safer sexual practices, change in number of sexual partners and the like. And we've also seen historically and continue to see in sex-segregated institutions like prisons and ships and monasteries, we see people of heterosexual orientation sometimes substituting homosexual acts because the cost of heterosexual intercourse is very high because of unavailability of sexual partners. And even with somewhat subtle and esoteric problems, seeing how, for example, people react to the availability of tests for the AIDS virus, whether that leads people, as public health officials believe, anyone who tests and tests negative will be so sensitized to the risks of disease that the person will immediately engage in safe sex. Whereas Tom Phillipson and I argue that, on the contrary, that person, having passed the test successfully, may actually be in a position to get more risky sex by being able to persuade his sexual partner that that person is not at risk from him. So, but what troubles me, though, is the, and I think this is a general problem with these areas of non-market behaviors, very poor data. Very difficult to get data about these very private activities, and there's a sort of pervasive skepticism about these data, about their accuracy, despite all the efforts that the survey researchers use to.
Let me try to give two pieces of so-called evidence. One seems consistent to me with rational choice, and I think it is consistent with rational choice, and I think it's important. And the other, which puzzles me a great deal, and I don't know if maybe the data are bad. I mean, that's a good way to resolve puzzles, but I'm not sure that's the resolution here. The important piece of evidence, and it's just one study that I'm familiar with, I'm sure you're aware of the study, is the one by Joe Hotz and Tom Phillipson, and a third co-author recently, on whether people seem to be responding in their sexual or contraceptive use and other practices to different areas where the incidence of AIDS varies. And apparently they have found that where the incidence of AIDS is greater, people are more careful in their sex. Now, that's precisely the kind of prediction we would get out of rational choice, not only in AIDS, but in a related area of public and private health that, again, Tom Phillipson has found in his study of vaccinations, that people are more likely to get vaccinated when the risk of contracting a disease is greater. Now, that's obvious from a rational choice perspective, but it's often omitted in epidemiology models and the like. So that seems good and consistent and would surprise maybe some people that these effects are important. Not that they exist, but that they're important. On the other hand, the puzzle, there may be poor data, as I said, is Africa, where AIDS is by all accounts and all the evidence, enormously widespread. The risk is high, very great. And it's been claimed, and maybe the claim is just wrong, that as yet, even among the more educated people, the use of condoms as a contraceptive device has not been spreading that rapidly. And while the cost of this would be really great for this population, yet compared to the adverse consequences, particularly for high school people and so on, the cost seems minor. And so I don't understand that. I don't know if you've seen any better data on this or have thought about that issue. That's the other side of it that has puzzled me some.
Yes. We have not studied the AIDS picture in Africa in any systematic way, although actually I'm going to be giving a paper at the World Bank next spring on this subject. I think there are complicated political factors. Some governments in Africa have simply denied the existence of an AIDS problem and have refused to facilitate the distribution of condoms. So there's actually a condom shortage in parts of Africa. And I think to explain such a phenomenon, one really has to switch focus from the economics of rational sexual behavior, the economics of government. But some of the problems in Africa, I think, are intelligible. One is that transmission is very much more from prostitutes than it is in the United States. Prostitution is a much more important institution of sexuality in Africa, in part because of very extensive migrant labor. So men are often working hundreds of miles from their home, and there's a large market for prostitution. Once you have a situation in which there's a very high incidence of infection, due in part to the fact that other sexually transmitted diseases are endemic in Africa, and they greatly increase susceptibility to infection with the AIDS virus. So you now have many women who, because they're infected, do not have good alternatives to prostitution. Their marriage prospects are very poor. So you have a very large supply of infected prostitutes.
But wouldn't that, if I may interrupt, wouldn't that lead then these males to have even greater reason to use condoms? Because, you know, if your sex is within your wife or maybe another partner, you feel the risks aren't so great. But now everybody generally knows you're going to a prostitute in that environment, it's a risky activity. And it may prevent you from going, but if you go, I would think you'd be even more likely. The demand for condoms by such people, I would have thought, would be even stronger.
Well, I think there you would expect a large demand for condoms, but it would be affected by, one is, if the disease is already very widespread, so that a man believes that he has a high probability of already being infected, then his demand for condoms will fall. If the supply of condoms is restricted by government policy, price will be very high. In addition, the transmission rate, the transmissibility of the AIDS virus is much greater from men to women than from women to men. So, in fact, the risk that the man faces with the prostitute, even if she is infected, is relatively small. It's not so small that you can't have, over a period of years, enormous transmission of the disease. But in the particular instance, maybe relatively small. He may think that there's a good probability it's already infected, and the price may be high. And for all these reasons, there may be a sufficient amount of unshielded but highly risky sex to spread the disease.
Well, it's about, you know, I share your conviction that if we understood the situation better, we probably would be able to explain it, because, I mean, the incentive effects to being more careful should be, for some of the population, should be very powerful. And while the data I've seen on the cost of, condoms in Africa is relatively high, still compared to the potential consequences, it seems. So I suspect we're going to, we'll understand, and I hope before you give your World Bank paper, you will have gone into this you'll resolve some of these puzzles. But as I say, to me, up and now, in terms of the knowledge I had, it struck me as somewhat puzzling that we didn't see more of a movement. Because if you look at the use of condoms, my favorite example that had nothing to do with AIDS, but in an environment where the pressures not to use are very strong, as in Ireland, a very devout population, great pressures from the church not to use condoms. And nevertheless, we know two things. The objective fact, the birth rates have gone down enormously in Ireland. And so we said, how has it happened? It hasn't been because the population is less healthy or they're marrying later. If anything, they're marrying earlier than they did in the past. But and the evidence that is available in condom use suggests enormous increase in condoms. So this is not a government that's prevented it.
Right.
The government has been neutral. But there is another powerful institution there, the church, that has argued very much against it. And this is a very frequent, the highest, as far as I know, from studies of Andy Greeley and others in international comparison, is the highest rate of church attendance of any country that has been in the sample. So it's a very devout population. And nevertheless, when push came to shove, so to speak, the great advantage of restricting births, in this case, not AIDS, that's not the problem, but restricting births versus their religious beliefs, they've accommodated their religious beliefs to the pressures they were faced here. And I think that's, you can find many other examples of that type. And I suspect you're going to see that going on, or if not already going on in Africa, in those cases maybe where it is risky. If we can isolate out the sexual activities where the risks are great, where people aren't infected, or they don't believe, young people coming from, say, educated families who I would think we would find that they are using it.
Yeah. You know, there are interesting parallels between the African problem with AIDS and the problem in the American black community. In fact, I would think it's a particular challenge for the economist to show that the reason for the very high incidence of AIDS in Africa and the very high incidence in the American black community is not racial or is not cultural in a sense that can't be referred to rational factors. But for example, in the United States, the incidence of AIDS among black women per capita is 10 times what it is among white women. And it's considerably higher among black men than among a white men. Phillipson and I argue that there are economic reasons for this, having to do, for example, with the fact, I don't know whether there's an African parallel, that there is a very low ratio of black men who are sort of on the market for sexual relationships and black women. It has partly to do with patterns of interracial dating, partly having to do with a high imprisonment rate and homicide rate among black men. But it seems as if, because of this ratio, black men are in a position to, in their, you know, implicit negotiations with women, to sort of shift the burden of precaution onto the women. And therefore, the men are reluctant to use condoms. And the women may have to choose, if they want to have a sexual relationship, between very risky sex and no sex. So now another very important factor in the high incidence of AIDS in the black community in the United States is drug use. Because it's common for intravenous drug users to share needles, and if the needles have not been decontaminated, then they're very dangerous. In fact, decontamination is easy. Just dipping a needle in household liquid bleach will destroy the AIDS virus, and that word is gradually spreading. Mm-hmm. But the high incidence of drug addiction among blacks, that's something outside of our analysis, but I wonder whether your studies of addiction have cast light on that.
Well, that's an interesting issue. I was going to try to also link the AIDS issue in part with the drug use, because as you say, it is linked in general. Blacks important because blacks are more heavily involved in drugs, although drug use is non-trivial, and as you know, in the white populations. And the drug issue, let me say, is another one of these issues that people say, well, you cannot explain that with a rational choice perspective, that this is due to other factors. These are not people who get involved in drugs, who get addicted to drugs, are not thinking ahead. They're not making a rational decision, even in a limited way. And therefore, that's an area that one has to bring to bear, cultural, psychological, or whatever, but not much in rational choice. And as you know, I got interested in that issue a few years ago precisely because I considered it one of these boundary areas that can let us give us some information. Well, if we hit the boundary in this area, or not? Is this something that we can incorporate? My own conclusion, and that of a number of other people who have been working on the drug issue from a rational choice perspective, has been that I can't say, you know, everything can be explained. A lot of things, as in most of these areas, we still don't know. Maybe they're outside the boundary. But a lot of what we see about addictions, including the greater incidence of blacks, but also other attributes of addictions, and not only to drugs, but to cigarettes, to alcohol, and to many other activities that are generally agreed, maybe crime, to be have an element of strong habit or addiction, that they have very powerful rational choice aspects to them. And let me give a maybe a couple of examples of what I mean by that. The rational choice perspective in this context would say that people's decisions about using drugs depend partly on what pleasures they get today, and that may be motivated by a very unhappy situation, being in a ghetto, peer pressure. There are a variety of factors that could do it, which might explain why young people in poor ghetto environments, blacks, are more likely to get involved. But they also have, if they have an elements of rationality, they have to look a little bit to the future and recognize that there is a chance, maybe a good chance, that they will be addicted in the future. Although for most of these addictive goods, the likelihood of remaining addicted is much lower than people anticipate. But they'd have to recognize that. Nevertheless, it could be a rational decision, and that's where I think some of the critics go wrong, to say, well, yes, there are bad consequences in the future, but I don't have to neglect these consequences to conclude that it's worthwhile for me to experiment with drugs today. The addiction may not be certain, or the gain I'm getting now is so great, or I expect in the future my life will be better, will make it easier for me to get out of drugs, I'll be married, I'll have a job, whatever it may be, that my the storm, youthful storms that people go through will have passed to some extent, whatever the reason is. That would be the factor explaining. And then there would be, well, one might say, but that's tautological. What else can you bring to bear on this? That's usually a criticism of rational choice as it gets into these areas. And so one has to look for implications that maybe are somewhat different or surprising. And there have been a number in the addiction case. One that's related to public policies is how well do people respond to changes in the cost of the activity. Public intervention in drug distribution, public punishment of offenders, a situation on the federal bench, you, I'm sure, deal with many of these since they're federal violations, and a lot of it's taken up with drug cases. Maybe not at the appellate level, but the earlier level. So the price is very high. People estimate it's 10 times what it would be if you had a free market. Now, what does that mean about use? Well, let me put the problem in reverse. If we made various drugs legal, and that had an effect of greatly lowering the price, would we see much of an increase in consumption? Now, the naive view of this, or the non-rational view, let me not call that naive, that's pejorative. The view that takes a different approach might say, well, addicts don't respond much to price. I've even heard many economists say that. Now, the theory, the rational choice theory of addiction, not only says they respond to price, but says in the long run, addicts tend to respond more to price than people who are not addicted to respond to similar types of goods. The response initially may not be so large, but the ultimate response would be large. That's the implication of it. And in two forms, some addicts will stop being addicted and some people will not become addicted as a result of the high cost. And this has been studied for some goods, not so much for drugs yet because the data on price and use are not available, but for cigarettes and alcohol, one does find big long-run responses and smaller, although not negligible, even short-run responses, so that by affecting price, tax on cigarettes or alcohol, or this intervention in drugs, we probably have affected, and maybe substantially, the amount of addiction. The cost may be great, but we've affected the amount of addiction substantially. And that would be one type of implication. that I think runs counter to a lot of beliefs about the relation between price and addictions that comes out of rational choice, and I think is consistent with the evidence that we know have on this so far.
The way you describe addiction, it sounds, how do you differentiate it from simply a preference for present over future, present benefits over future costs?
Well, every rational act clearly involves a comparison between present and the future. Every act involves that. Now, the special characteristics of an addiction are, one, that you're comparing present benefits and harmful addictions, at least of the sort of addictions that we usually, society is concerned about, like drugs and smoking and so on. Get a gain today and the cost is in the future. And the reason that raises questions about rationality is that those who believe that people don't look ahead, are myopic, aren't rational, well, they neglect these gains in the future, costs in the future, so they take the action today. And if they knew what they were going to get themselves into, they wouldn't have done it, but they don't calculate. That's why it's good for the rational choice perspective. The other attribute of rationality, which I didn't bring out, so I'm glad you raised that, is that my act of consuming today affects my desire to consume in the future. That's what we mean.
Merely because you like it? Or is there some added element? And presumably, if I do something, maybe I eat peanuts and I like them, well, then I'm likely to eat them tomorrow. I may know there are long-run effects, but every day I enjoy them. But is that enough for addiction? Or do you have in mind some you know, subclass of pleasurable goods with harmful future effects
that makes them addiction? It's not easy to go from the peanut eating case, which would see it be a habit. It's habitual, it's habit. Eat peanuts, eat potato chips, and you want to eat more of them. Addictions are habitual. But the way I like to distinguish the two is addictions are such strong habits that they have other consequences. And one of the consequences is that they can lead to cumulative behavior so that you move very far away from where you start from. And by that I mean the following. I may start out consuming drugs in a mild way. I do it for a while, but each use reinforces my previous use, and that effect gets, at least for a while, gets stronger and stronger. So I may end up consuming an enormous amount, being what we would usually call addicted. Mm-hmm. I'm taking drugs all the time. I'm smoking two packs of cigarettes a day, five or six drinks a day, what we would call, distinguishes the ordinary habitual behavior. I eat potato chips for a while, I eat more, and I forget about it for a while, and then I may come back and a couple of days later eat them, and same with peanuts. Addictions have these long-run, for a while, cumulative impact, so that you end up very far from where you started out.
Well, but then isn't it, would one call it a form of obsession? I mean, suppose you love your work and you become a workaholic. Isn't that analytically the same?
I don't distinguish between the two, except maybe, you know, we have the beneficial future effects rather than the harmful from working hard. Or maybe there can be some harmful. Right. There are beneficial addictions. People with this approach have looked at jogging as an addiction. I like to say the most addictive of all things are people. And people get addicted to people, to spouses. So when a spouse dies, you find the type of consequence, withdrawal and so on, suicide. I mean, things that we often ordinarily associate with addiction. So I think there are a lot of activities that we call addiction, not all bad. Many of them we'd say, well, that's fine. We get addicted to your work. That's what leads to great accomplishment. I've never known somebody who has succeeded very well who wasn't addicted to their work, didn't get pleasure and worked very hard and so on.
Doesn't this suggest a very powerful argument for decriminalization? That is, addiction in itself, nothing wrong with that. It's a normal part of human behavior. It has many beneficial characteristics. But the form of addiction that each of us succumbs to depends entirely on opportunities and capacities and so on. So if you're a very limited person, your best addiction might be cocaine. So why would we want to deprive a person of that choice?
Well, that it isn't clear that we do want to. I'm in general in favor of addictions, permitting, say, legalizing drugs, but only partly on the grounds of what we call libertarian grounds, that people should be free to do what they want as long as they don't have consequences on the others. I think there's so many other harmful effects of addictions that even if we put even negative value attached to that, there's a case of decriminalization. But I would like to comment on the libertarian argument. And I don't want to push myself too far because I basically I'm a libertarian on a lot of these choice issues. The only case that I can see for being more qualified in one's attitude on the addiction case is the following, and it also really involves partly rational choice analysis, but in a different dimension, and even maybe an even more controversial one. Now, as we've seen, addictions, habits, you affect your future preferences. What I do now, we agree, is going to affect in the future. For minor things like potato chips, it won't mean very big changes and so on. But for things like drugs, for living with a wife or a husband, it does change. You like the person more, you hate them more after a while, but your preferences do change for them. All right, so what we do today, the environment we experience today, is going to affect what we want tomorrow. Now, that can be put into a rational choice perspective. To the extent that people anticipate that, we are all to some extent choosing the type of people we want to be in the future. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's good. I mean, that can lead to great achievement. We can make ourselves better people than we are. The problem, however, if there is a problem, or at least makes me somewhat less enthusiastic about the libertarian outlook here, and slightly more sympathetic to some of the, even my conservative friends who are appalled by the idea of decriminalizing it, is that people's preferences are not only formed by what they do, but they're formed by what their parents did to them, or for them, or not for them, and by the environment they lived in. And consider drugs. As we said before, this has hit blacks more than others. And it's hit black more than others, not because of some, in my judgment, intrinsic propensity for blacks to be more drug using. There's no evidence to my knowledge on that. But their family background has been different. They've come from families with greater drug use. Their peer pressure in the ghetto has been very strong to use drugs. So the preferences that they are forming in this way are not necessarily preferences that I think we want to use the consumer sovereignty to respect. These preferences are as good as any others. Taking these preferences as given, yes. And then you go down the libertarian view. But do you want to take them as given? And I would say two issues in particular. One, the influence of peer pressure. Even in a conventional analysis of libertarian choice, that is an externality, an interaction. If what I do or what affects you, what you do affects me, that may be things we'd want to control. So that's relatively easy. And I think it's one reason that leads me to hesitate, that I think addictions have these activities. The other one, I'm on more slippery ground, but I'm not sure in my own mind that if my preferences are formed now because my parents were uncaring, they beat me, all the things that we would say. Do we want to take a consumer sovereignty approach in that case? Or do we want to say, well, it may pay to interfere with these preferences, even though during the transition to the new state, that person's going to be made worse off by interfering? And that, I'm not have a strong view on that, but it leads me to hesitate in simply adopting a libertarian view.
I think that's a powerful argument you're making for intervention possible intervention in the drug case, but its implications are worrisome because what you're now saying is we can question the authenticity of a person's preferences. We can question them on the ground that the person did not emerge from a conventional family structure. or that the person associates with questionable people. And I wonder whether that doesn't lead to the kind of conservatism associated with people like James Q. Wilson and Irving Kristol and Alan Bloom and many others, which says that it is an appropriate, may not be entirely feasible, but it's in principle it's an appropriate task of government and society to create a family structure to encourage monogamy, to discourage divorce, to discourage alcoholism, to try to create for these children a traditional American middle class type family, so that we channel young people into the same path. And then there are implications for what we do about, you know, whether we permit gay marriage or other, permit people to live in communes, permit lesbians to adopt children, and so on. And you can see how potentially, a potentially invasive role of government. How important do you think it is to try to reconstruct the traditional sort of 1950s style American middle class family life?
Well, you know, the points you make are important ones and difficult ones. I mean, most of us, I think, and probably you and I would say, well, even if there was something to some of these arguments, we wouldn't trust government to carry them out very effectively, and they'll make things worse rather than better. And you give government that much power that they can be deciding what's values and so on, that'll be a disaster. And so even if I fully believe the lines of arguments I was saying and believe it was applicable, I wouldn't say that's a case for government intervention. It may make me hesitate about consumer sovereignty, but it's not a case for government intervention. But let's leave that to one side. Suppose we could accomplish some of these things. That's the question you're raising. Should we try to do it? Well, I have, you know, mixed reactions to that. On the one hand, I think those people who want to go back to the families of the 1950s, early 1960s, 40s, they live in a dream world. The world is different now. And the world is different in ways, many ways that are good ways. Do they really want to take women out of the marketplace and put them back in the household, rearing children? Do they want the same birth rates that we had in those days? I mean, the fundamentalists in Iran, the Khomeinis are saying, let's take women out of the labor force. And they've tried to do it, not very successfully there, because the pressures even for them are too strong. So one doesn't have to be somebody who accepts as wonderful everything has happened to recognize that that's foolish to think you're going to be able to do that. High divorce rates, I think, are here with us. Women working are here, and I think that's very good. Lower birth rates are here, and that, given people's choices, that's fine. They want more educated children. They want to put more into them. Why should we say that that's not right? So that type of family, I think, we cannot attain. At least it should not be a goal. And there's a nostalgia behind all this that I think is greatly misplaced and meaningless. Now, on the other hand, if one says, well, but do you really want so much, so many teenagers to be having children and not being married? Do you really want families where exercising no control over their children very much and not responsible? No, of course we would prefer, not simply because we have particular values, because these lead to adverse effects on society as a whole. We want people to have values toward honesty. I mean, crime hurts everybody. And so to the extent the family, which has been a traditional inculcator of the fact that people should be honest and so forth, to the extent that's broken down, I think that's a social harm, an externality, we would say. We would hope that that could be controlled. And I would like to see more control over that to the extent that society has to support many families because there are mothers with children that have no husband. That's a social cost, and not only a cost to taxpayers, But it's a cost to these children to the extent that their parents are not treating them well. And every society has a very difficult problem in deciding how many limits should you place on parental control over how many children they should have and how they should rear their children. And I don't think one can avoid that. One doesn't have to adopt these foolish views about going back to the 1950s to recognize that's a legitimate matter of social concern, because what's happening there is affecting everybody. And it's affecting the young people in these families who we feel we, as a society, we have responsibilities to providing a more equal opportunity. So when I come back to these interferences in the values that are being formed, it's partly my concern of what's happened, what the impact on the rest of us, as with peer pressure. That's an easy case to get at. That is an external effect. That if people are smoking more because each individual is encouraging others to smoke, you may end up with more smoking than each of them would prefer if they can move themselves to a position where they're all smoking a little bit. You know, the problem in economics of multiple equilibria or so on. That is a real problem. I think it's relevant in the drug case. That's why I brought it up before. But let's leave that. I think that's relatively easy. I think in conventional, even using consumer sovereignty, we can understand those cases. The harder cases are the ones we were speaking about, when we get preference being formed, maybe because of bad family values. That isn't particularly harming other people, but is the person themselves would have been different if they had had a different outcome. And in a sense, if they could have chosen their path, they would have preferred to choose that other outcome. That's the way I would look at it. If these children could make the choices, they would have said, heck, I don't want this when I'm exposed to all this. I would have been preferred to be exposed to the black or white. It was true also in the black families, the much more stable families in the 1950s. And now I'm being exposed to this crummy thing. Society's not offering me any protection against this. There was no, I can't write a contract over. We may be better off if children could be writing contracts with their parents when the time, but I can't write a contract. And should we respect the values that are formed for me that I would prefer not to have had? Now, it's true, once I have them, I'm better off getting involved in drugs. And to me, that's a terrible paradox. I don't know how to answer that question. But I think it's a question we have to try to resolve in order to see how far we want to push these thinking about interfering with families, or how far we want to depart from consumer sovereignty once we take values as they're given.